Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 10K Collective podcast, the place to be for six, seven and eight figure Amazon sellers, particularly focused on the UK at the moment. And we have a Brit with us, as the Americans say, or a UK fellow Englishman, John Kant of Rising Sun Commerce. Rising Sun helps brands sell successfully on Amazon Japan. I was just joking with John that if you were from California, it would be helping you crush it awesomely. But being British, we're going to keep it more low key. So John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Yes. Thank you very much. Where are you coming to us from today?
So I'm in the UK at the moment. I'm in Hull in East Yorkshire.
Excellent. Nice to have a bit of Yorkshire home to use. The home of straight talking, if I remember. I studied there many years ago. So launching in Japan, it's a very big topic every so often, but to me, it seems like a really, really underused opportunity. So glad you could come and help us with, because I honestly think there's a hell of a lot of money to be made for existing sellers without too much trouble, is my understanding of it. But let's go through that. First of all, what is the process of expanding internationally from the sort of 50,000 foot view?
So, I mean, when you, as a seller, if you're trying to expand overseas, I think before you jump in, doing a bit of research, market research is definitely the place to start. You don't want to, you know, send a load of inventory to a new country and then find out there's no market when it's already too late. It's better to have a look at what's going on before you launch and do your homework, I guess.
Yeah, that makes total sense in most places. Now, my understanding of the Amazon Japan market, though, is that most of the usual research tools don't actually work very well there. I mean, is that still true? Am I out of date with that?
Yeah, no, that's true. You sort of Jungle Scout type things and Helium 10, they don't really cover Japan very well. So you're kind of rewinding the clock to before Jungle Scout existed, if any sellers were around then, when you kind of got to do the research kind of manually, really. There's no quick solution like with Jungle Scout these days. So, yeah. I mean, we've got our own sort of internal systems of how we estimate sales. But because the data is not readily available, it's quite, take it with a pinch of salt, you know, we do. But we, you know, it's better than nothing. We can look at and get a reasonable overview of what's going on. And we're getting better at it the more we do it as well. So
great. So you guys offer that as a service, which makes a lot of sense. I think for anyone who doesn't speak Japanese, I know that you speak Japanese, you've lived there, your wife's Japanese, so you're deep in that culture. So for most of us, that isn't going to be an option. So what is the way, if you have to do it as a non-native or as a non-Japanese speaker, what is the basic process for doing the manual product research in Japan?
I'd say there's two things to consider. One is, don't get intimidated by how it looks. Obviously, you know, Japanese is a completely different language to, you know, the Roman alphabet, and it does look like it's hard work, but at the end of the day, it's just characters on paper. And second, Google Translate for doing research is actually quite good. When it's doesn't work very well if you translate in big long sentences, but in terms of individual words, then it does a pretty reasonable job. So if you're selling, you know, whatever your product's main keyword search term is, if you type that into Google Translate, you should get something reasonable back and then be able to type that into Amazon Japan and get a feel for what's going on, you know, what type of similar products are selling.
Okay, that makes sense. And what's the next step after that?
So after that, if you're kind of going about doing the research yourself, you can get a feel for how well they're selling. You know, do they have lots of reviews? Are the reviews any good? You can look at the images to see, you know, the images are international, so you can get a feel for if they're good quality or not, just by looking. And then from a content perspective, you can see that the size of the description, you can see if the sellers are bothering to put any effort in, or if there might be an opportunity to improve on what's there in terms of sort of the size of the content, both bullet points and description. A lot of listings in Japan have enhanced content, or A+ content, whatever you call it. And historically, you didn't need to be brand registered to be able to have the A+ content. So a lot of listings do tend to have that. So you can see a lot of, you know, decent quality listings with lots of images on Amazon Japan.
Okay, so the competition level is reasonably high, and people sort of treat it as an add-on. I just remind people again that it's bigger than Amazon UK. I mean, it's pretty similar size, but it's the third biggest Amazon marketplace. So yeah, it's quite developed. I'd expect there to be a level of competition. It's interesting what you're saying about, I suppose, what we'd probably call in UK, USA, enhanced brand content. It may be A+, it may be whatever in Japan. But so there is a certain level of competition. What do we need to be looking at in order to... Well, I suppose make a decision. I'm assuming for a lot of people, for most people, that Japan is going to be a second or third marketplace they launch into after UK or USA or possibly Germany or somewhere like that. So what sort of criteria would you apply when you're assessing it? You've looked at the keyword research, you looked at the reviews, images, enhanced brand content, or A+ content. What sort of criteria would you use to say, yes, this looks like an opportunity, or no, this is going to be too competitive for us?
So when we do the sort of market research for clients, we you know, there are various factors that we take into account. It's kind of the number of reviews, review rating. We've got like a data model in the background, which, as I was saying, is kind of loose, but we can use it to get an idea of sales. So looking at the best seller rank of a particular product, in the sort of high level category, you can get a feel for how many it's selling per month. So you know that, you know, is it selling, you know, one or two a day, or is it selling 10 a day, or is it selling 100 a day kind of thing. You can get a feel for that type of, you know, sales level. It's not going to give you, you know, this is selling 37.3 per day or something like that, right, accurate. Yeah. But you can get a feel for demand for the products. And also, you know, as you were mentioning, what the competition is. So if there's lots of similar products and they've all got hundreds of five-star ratings and the demand is mediocre, then yeah, it probably doesn't make sense to kind of launch. But, you know, obviously the opposite of that, if you think that there's a listing which doesn't look particularly good, but demand seems to be quite high, then, you know, you take that as an opportunity and test the market and, yeah, get stuck in.
Yeah, sounds good. And I think what I quite like about this is, what I really like about it, whenever I find a somewhat moderate barrier to entry, I'm really happy. And, you know, when working with mentoring clients, they often aren't that happy. But I say, look, the fact, for example, that Jungle Scout, Helium 10, whatever, that everyone puts too much faith in, I'm not saying they're not useful tools, by the way, they have their place, they definitely do. But if you put too much faith in a machine and turn your brain off, particularly when it comes to allowing your intuition to kick in, or to educate your intuition if you're new, then I think you're getting over reliant on the wrong thing anyway. So I think the other thing is that a lot of people just will give up at that point, which is great because it thins the herd. It means your competition is just going to be less from outside of Amazon sellers. So yeah, it's really good.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, people I've spoken to have said, you know, what do you mean there's no Jungle Scout? How can I find a product to sell? And it's like, Well, use your brain, you know. Come up with some ideas and, you know, things can't be handed to you on a plate, you know. I know they are sometimes, but, you know, you need to do the work. And I agree, if there's barriers to entry that stops other people entering the market, then yeah, that's good, because it means there's there's less competition.
Absolutely. Given that on Amazon, demand is normally pretty good, unless you're looking at a really small marketplace like Spain, for example, in Europe. I mean, yes, a few people make some good sales there, but not many. But if you're looking at a substantial demand marketplace like Japan, which is, as I said, the size of Amazon UK, so it's got to be, what, $10, $11 billion a year or something like that? But it's substantial. So the main thing is not actually demand, it's competition in most markets, right? You might find something very obscure. But so having the inability to use Jungle Scout is great. And I point out to people as well that Jungle Scout is not something that's going to give you quotes at the edge. It's a wonderful tool, but it's a kind of entry level activity if you're in the US, UK, Germany, because the Chinese sellers use it and the Chinese factories will be, you know, there are 40, 50 factories. I was talking to Kevin King the other day who probably have several tens of thousands of employees between them and dominate Amazon from the Chinese perspective and therefore dominate Amazon full stop. You know, they launch crazy numbers of SKUs. So if you're using Jungle Scout, so are they. So and they're seeing the same opportunities. So I really think I can't stress enough how great it is that Jungle Scout doesn't really work in Japan. And there's nothing against that tool or Greg. He's a great guy, but I just think it's brilliant. And also the idea, the other thing that I would point out is that the false accuracy, sorry, John, I'm just banging on a soapbox here, but I just think it's so critical to understand the idea that you have this accuracy from Helium 10, Jungle Scout, Viral Launch. They're all good tools, but none of them have the sort of get to tap Amazon at source since December last year that got cut off. So they're all working on old data. So none of them are 100% accurate anyway. So thinking you're 100% accurate and making really precision plans, but on the basis of that, I think is more dangerous than knowing that what you're doing is just an estimate, but you can say, yeah, it's between 1 and 3 a day, or it's 10 to 15 a day. I think that's actually more honest, you know? So I think there's a lot in favor of this. I really, having to go back to basics, I think is a really good thing. But anyway, I'm banging on about this, but I just think, you know, as you were implying, get over the addiction to the tools and, you know, start making your own decisions. I really think it's great.
I don't know if you mentioned about the size of the market earlier. I think, you know, as you said, it's about the same size as the UK now. But obviously, Japan has double the population of the UK. It's 127 million. So there's potential for it, Amazon Japan to grow, I think, and Amazon's wave to, you know, get bigger and bigger. So
it's a very good point. I mean, yeah, thank you for reminding us of that. I mean, the percentage of the population in the UK that shops online, I think is the biggest in the world as a percentage. So the growth potential is going to be lower there. So that's a very good point, actually. So not only is Japan a little bit bigger than the UK, but yeah, I'd imagine that the potential for it could be much, much bigger in the future as well.
Yeah, yeah, I think what
have you got any stats on the sort of growth rates of that? I mean, I don't know anything about those statistics.
So in terms of the market share that Amazon has in Japan, it's been growing significantly over recent years. And the last data I saw, it was about 22%, I think, of market share. So 22% of e-commerce transactions in Japan were done on Amazon.
Okay. Well, given that it's closer to half in America, you can imagine that the trend might well be towards, you know, much higher than that.
Yeah. I mean, it's been accelerating quickly, sort of. I think 7 or 8 years ago, it was at about 12%. So it's kind of doubled. So it's growing for sure.
Interesting. So that's a very, very important point. So you want to be in a growth market, all things being equal. If you can get a good toehold in a growth market and stay there and not lose market share to rivals, that's how people get rich, because that's where fast growth comes. So that's even yet another reason to be there, which I wasn't really conscious of. So yeah.
The way I think of it as well, it's easier, you know, if you're looking at kind of getting to the top of the listings, the top of the charts, it's easier to get there when the market is, you know, smaller. And then, you know, it's harder for people to kick you off as it grows, I think. So that's the way I look at it. So even if, you know, sales aren't as high as obviously the US or Germany now, if you get to the, you know, top of the rankings while the competition is low, then you can stay there for the long term.
Absolutely. And also, I'd like to point out that the gaps aren't that huge. I mean, Amazon US, I mean, I think like from 2016, that's the latest stats I've got, which is shameful. I need to look it up. But it was something like $90 billion total market revenue, or whatever the technical word is. You know, so the amount of money that was, massive money that was, you know, changed hands in there. actual marketplace, including Amazon and third-party sellers. But I, you know, Germany was 14 billion, the UK was 11 billion, and then Japan was like 11.5 or something. So it's not actually that far away. I mean, if Japan grows like Topsy for the next 3 or 4 years, it'll overtake Germany. I could definitely imagine that happening. I mean, Germany's population is about 88 million. Japan is, what, 120-something million, you said? So it could become actually the second biggest marketplace. And even if it doesn't, I mean, as you say, I really think you're 100% right. It's much easier to grab a piece of the market when the market's smaller and then ride it the way to the top by staying on top, which is another art, but it's not easier than getting established in the first place. So yeah, even more reasons to go into it. Thank you. It's a really powerful opportunity, I think. Then the more I hear about it from you and the more we discuss it, the more I think, yeah, is this really even bigger than I thought? So John, let's backpedal a little bit. Give me a little bit about your background. How did you end up being a specialist in Amazon Japan? What's your sort of background and the foundation of Rising Sun Commerce?
Well, I think like a lot of people who start businesses, it's never a straightforward path, is it?
No, this hasn't been for me, that's for sure, no.
Exactly. So in 2005, no, in fact, rewind a couple of years before that, I was living in London, working as a programmer, and met a Japanese girl, and she wanted to go back home to family and hang out move back to Japan. So I thought, that sounds interesting. So yeah, I'll go to Japan for a year. So I went back with her, lived with her for a year, but then it turned into 5 years, and then we got married and stuff. So that's sort of how I got into the Japan side of life. And then we moved back to the UK in 2010, and I met my business partner, Neil. He runs a private label brand on Amazon that he'd been running for a while, and he wanted to grow his business and was looking at new markets. And we got chatting one day, and he knew that I lived in Japan, so he was like, oh, Japan could be interesting. So we kind of teamed up and sent a batch of his products to Japan, and it went reasonably well. And then we thought, there's probably other brands out there, other businesses that, you know, want to sell in Japan too. And that's kind of how the agency side came about and how we started helping other brands to sell on Amazon Japan. So we've been going for about 2 years now as an agency.
Okay. So scratching your own itch to start with, which is always the good clue of how to create a business. And I would say, again, the same is true with the product. If you know nothing about a product and you're purely led by the numbers, I know some people who've done very well that way, but I think that's the exception to the rule. I think most of the time, whether it's a physical product or a business, it's good to know that at least you've got one customer, which is yourself, right? I think that's always a good starting point. Yeah, great. Okay, so what would you say then, having lived in Japan for 5 years, are the main sort of cultural differences as is relevant to e-commerce specifically and anything else that is relevant to marketing in general?
So I guess the biggest differences I saw, I mean, Japan is an interesting place because in many ways it's very technologically advanced, and then in some ways it's kind of a bit backwards and you're like, really? So for example, when I was living there, even in 2010, I had to fax my timesheet, which is bizarre. But on the other hand, they've got like the most amazing trains in the world. Even in 2005, when I moved there, everybody had TVs and internet on their phone, you know, long before the iPhone came along. So yeah, it's an interesting place. In terms of sort of e-commerce and from a product point of view, you know, generally speaking, people overthink it, I think. The one difference is Q4 is nowhere near as big in Japan as what it is in the US and Europe. They're not a Christian country, and there's not the sort of present giving culture at Christmas time. So you don't see that massive upsurge in Q4 like you see over here. So, and then obviously the Christmas related products and, you know, not really a thing either. But other than that, you know, they like high quality products. It's quite a high population density. So, you know, especially in the big cities, people don't have too much space in their apartments. So they tend to buy quality products rather than buying lots of, you know, cheap products. You know, they don't because they don't have much space. They prefer quality, I think.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's interesting, their relationship with technology, when generally, you know, the smallest smartphones normally ahead of the curve. But yeah, I like the fact you think don't overthink it. So there's some specific differences. So it's kind of obvious when you think about it that you're not going to do Christmas. But also the fact that they're like high quality products, it reminds me of Germany, really, which is similarly not that crowded a country, but quite a big wealthy population. And I think the wealthier the population, the more they want quality products. And in the US, Casey Gorse was sharing at a conference I went to a while ago that in Amazon, I think in the US, the average income of the average buyer is sort of somewhere in the below $50,000 a year market. So it's still a mass market geared to the lower sort of earners. I think one has to sort of tweak that a little bit for Japan and Germany. Has that been your experience?
The thing about Japan is, you know, there's not really extreme levels of wealth or poverty. It's, you know, it's fairly even, I'd say. You know, but you know, like Scandinavian countries, you know, you don't get the extremes. You know, it's the general audience, really. You're not really catering to really high end or really low end kind of thing, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, okay. That's an interesting point about the society as a whole. So I guess that the quality thing, I mean, would you say there are some products that you could cheerfully sell in Amazon.com, which would be risky to sell in Amazon Japan based on the quality level?
Based on the quality level, I mean, yes, perhaps, but everybody likes a bargain as well, don't they? You know, when they see the price. So yes and no. I think I'd spin it the other way, in that if you've got a high quality product, don't be afraid to go for it in Japan kind of thing, because people are willing to pay for quality.
Okay, that's a nice way around of putting it, actually. I mean, I do think that erring on the side of quality these days is wise, because you've got more compliance. For example, you have to get GS1 barcodes these days if you don't want to risk account suspension, or at the very least product suspension. And that's just another, you know, whatever, 100 and something pounds a year. It's not a lot, $150. Maybe it's a bit more including VAT, but it's just an example of there's quite a lot more overheads now that you have to have, which were before optional. You have to have product liability insurance. So with that situation, I just think you want to be getting some more, not just the gross margin percentage, but in absolute terms per sale, you want to be getting a reasonable chunk of cash, I think. So
yeah,
I think that ties in with where we need to go. Plus the market's growing up and maturing in all the marketplaces, and low quality stuff just won't really sell very well. So I just think it's wise to err on the side of quality, which again, sounds like it ties in with Japan quite nicely. So are there any differences in the type of product that you can sell in Japan, or is it broadly similar to the US or UK or anywhere like that?
Yeah, no, I'd say generally speaking, it's broadly similar, really. I'd say for the fashion products are maybe less developed and more basic on Amazon Japan than we see over here in Europe and the US. Now, that's not to say, you know, fashion in Japan is a very big industry. It's just that we're not really seeing, you know, the types of diversity of clothes on Amazon at the moment, but I'm sure that might change in the future.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I mean, fashion is a big thing in Japan, as I understand it. I remember that a couple of Japanese friends that I knew at music college said that in Tokyo, people will spend crazy amounts of money on things like Louis Vuitton handbags. Apparently, the fashion spend in Tokyo is higher than Paris, as I understood it. So I don't know if that's accurate, but it sounds like that.
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't surprise me.
Sounds like there might be an opportunity there. If the general, you know, appetite for fashion in Japan is really high, but the offering on Amazon Japan is quite low, then I guess that says opportunity, right? That sounds like an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, the way I sort of think about it is, if you're an international, you know, if you're in the fashion, if you've got a fashion brand, because the search volume, I don't think, for those type of clothes is there on Amazon, but you could still use Amazon for fulfillment purposes and do your marketing away from Amazon, but then send customers to Amazon to buy the products for that sort of level of trust and things, if you didn't have the resources to, you know, set up a fulfillment center in Japan or use a distributor. You know, if you wanted to test the market and go through an e-commerce route, then I think that type of solution is kind of an interesting one. But
that's very interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And again, I think in terms of overall trends, the off Amazon marketing, but using Amazon for sales because they have the trust and they have the credit cards on file, and for fulfillment because they're so good at that, particularly somewhere like Japan, where it's going to be tricky and to find English-speaking fulfillment houses and what have you. That makes a great deal of sense. And again, I think that's quite a smart way to start approaching even the US as well, especially as the fulfillment on Amazon offering gets more expensive. So talking of which, let's talk about fulfillment by Amazon in Japan. I mean, does it work in the same way as in other countries? Is there any big differences?
Yep, it's almost identical. The only difference to highlight is that the storage fees tend to be more, or they are more expensive in Japan compared to Europe and the USA. So the fees in Japan throughout the year are round about the same as Q4 fees for the UK. I've not got the spreadsheet up in front of me at the moment.
Don't worry, we can put them in the show notes. And if you want the show notes, by the way, just go over to 10kcollective.com and you can find plenty of notes, which I'm busy typing as we speak here. But yeah, what I would say is same as Q4 in the UK. What I would point out, however, is that people need to really, really clock just how expensive Q4 in the US is in terms of fulfillment by Amazon, because quite rightly, they have quite limited capacity these days relative to the amount of fulfillment they've got to do. And the Q4 fees in the US are sort of at least twice the usual fees. And again, I don't have it in front of me. I'll put it on the show notes, but it's pretty expensive. And I think it is worth bearing in mind that that's a quarter of the year, quarter. it's really something you've got to take account of, because Japan needs to be put in context. It's expensive throughout the year, sure. But if you average out per unit sales, because obviously a lot of the unit sales are going to be made in Q4 in the USA, you might find it's not actually that different. So again, it's just something you need to actually, a lot of going into a new market, like going abroad, I don't know if you found that, but going to Germany when I was in my sort of late teens really threw up made me reflect on England. And going to Amazon Japan makes you reflect on Amazon other places. And actually, it's not always that different. I think that's the other thing, is that just on a cultural point of view, the US is not the same as the UK. It is a different culture. And in fact, for example, for you say, our way of helping people is to help Amazon sellers sell in Japan. The Americans would say that's an extremely kind of low key. That's not good enough. It needs to be super awesome, helping you crush it in Japan. And that's a joke, but it isn't a joke, because I speak to a lot of Americans for their podcast, and it is a different culture. So I think sometimes we're fooled by the idea that US is friendly and the same kind of culture, and Japan is deeply different. And actually, in some ways, I think the US is quite different as well. So we need to put it in context rather than going, oh, Japan, that's scary and foreign, and the US, that's friendly and same. It's like, not really. Language may be the same, but it's not quite the same culture. So,
yeah, for sure.
Anyway, yes, indeed. I'm totally putting you off the road there. Sorry.
It's all right. I mean, it's the same for everyone. Everybody that's using FBA, it's the same fees for everybody. So it's just the case of being aware of them and building it into your pricing, I think. That's the, that's what I'd highlight on that. It's not, just be aware of them, basically.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, and you're not at a disadvantage compared to any other sellers there, yeah. And so they're used to paying a price that reflects that, I guess, as well. Okay, that's a very good point. So we talked about clothing, and that's a bit of a different area, although the fashion offering is more basic, but there's not quite the search volume. But that brings us to the question of the differences as well. I understand that clothing's an area where you need to be a little bit careful with what you sell. So where's the difference there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sizing of clothing is that can be a challenge as well. Japanese people tend to have different shaped bodies. So the sizing, if you're selling clothing, is going to be a bit of a challenge. In terms of other challenges, there's the compliance issue of some products that we need to get around. Although clothing, it's relatively straightforward, but things like electronic products and toys and food related products, you need product testing to be done and get your paperwork in order to be allowed to sell them through FBA.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about the compliance side. That's always like something that strikes fear into everyone's hearts. I mean, what sort of categories would cause you to have to think about that?
Sure. So it's like food related, kitchenware, cosmetics, medical products, toys and electrical products are the main ones.
Okay. Would that include very simple toys as well, like sort of wooden ones or little plastic ones that you don't have to sort of know electronics in it, or is that?
I'm not sure, to be honest. We've not really done any toys yet. Okay. So I've not looked in that much detail at it.
No, it's fair enough. And to be fair to you, it's a very product-specific, kind of category-specific thing about compliance, isn't it? I mean, what's the...
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're doing that, would EU CE markings, EU legislation or American standards be enough, or do you need different testing for Japan?
So it needs Japan-specific testing, but... You know, it's nothing to be afraid of in the sense that, you know, it's not, I don't think it's any more stringent than Europe or the US. It's just a case of in Japan, they have their own system and they, you know, they've got their own paperwork that they do, and they don't recognize the sort of international standards, and they've got their own version of it. So there's kind of, you know, it's not like the product will fail the tests. You know, if you're selling it in Europe and in the US, then there's nothing to be particularly afraid of, I don't think. It's just a case of, you know, getting the paperwork done and the compliance and the documents sorted.
Yeah, okay. So how expensive is a process like that then, roughly? I mean, it's how long is a piece of string? I know.
yeah. Depends on the category. For food-related products, you're looking probably around about £1,000, £1,000 to £2,000 maybe, depending on various factors. But yeah, for kind of medical equipment and things like that, you're looking at sort of £5,000 to £10,000.
Quite serious, but yeah, okay. And so we're mentioning pounds. I was about to automatically translate it to dollars because it's kind of the currency of the internet. So we're they're getting quite similar, folks. So about $1.3 per pound. So it's like we were talking about $1,300 to $3,500, $2,500, $3,000. But so for food related stuff, so not too terrible. Talking of dollars, do you help American sellers sell? Is it only UK sellers that you help, or who do you actually work with?
Yeah, no, we help people from all over the world. Yeah, we've got some US based clients. We've got help people from European clients, and we've got a fair proportion of clients in the UK as well.
Cool. So I suppose just coming back to the medical products, just to translate in case you wonder what the hell a pound is worth, which is not an unreasonable thing these days. I suppose we're looking about $7,000 to sort of $12,000-$13,000, aren't we? So for those, so obviously that's quite specialist. I imagine that if you're in that area, you already know quite a bit about compliance because you've had to deal with it. But so how do people go about that?
Yeah, I mean, the clients that we've spoke to, they know to some extent more than we do. You know, where I know about Amazon and content on Amazon and stuff. I'm not a particular specialist in terms of the compliance side, but we're getting our contents, our contacts in place, and we just connect people with the right people in Japan that can help solve these issues.
Great. That was my next question, is how do you solve them? But you basically answered that. I mean, do you help with it? Do these guys normally speak English, or do you act as a sort of intermediary and translator?
Again, it depends on the individual company. Some do have English support, some don't. And it's good. Sometimes it's good for us to be in the loop anyway, so we know what we're going on, but what's going on, and we can, you know, help our client in that way. But where... We don't mind whether we're involved or not, as long as the problem is solved. So.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Now, it's reassuring to know that you can be part of it. I think it is always a good idea to have a general, especially if it's if you're putting together outsourced agencies, but even if it's internal team. I just these days insist on a team meeting 3 times a week, even though the part-time team that I've got working on the podcast, for example. And I just think the danger of not communicating is much bigger than the danger of over communicating when you're dealing with international situations. So yeah, it's good to have somebody who's got an overview like yourselves, who've been through it before and can just use the voice of common sense. Sometimes can be quite useful, like, actually don't do that, you could in theory, but in practice it's not a good idea, you know.
Yeah,
I'm sure that you provide that.
Our clients know a lot more about it than us in many ways, because it's there products and they're used to selling them internationally in other markets and stuff, so that they know kind of what's expected and what the processes are, generally speaking.
Of course.
So
tell me, is that going to be a thing that most people have to do, or in most categories of products outside of testing and compliance needs like they are in the US UK?
Yeah, so most, you know, if it's a simple product, then yeah, there's no real compliance documents required, you know. Yeah, it's fairly straightforward. You can just send it in to the FBA centres.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And again, just to flip it on its head, I think that again, that thing of like when you go to somewhere that's obviously foreign, you, if you like, in the broader sense, you take more trouble. But the fact is that, again, people sell stuff in the USA without compliance certification, or the UK or Germany, which is kind of really scary because Germany always has more laws than everywhere else. They like laws and regulations. And there's a lot of people cruising for a bruising with that because they don't have the certification that if Amazon turns around and asks for it one day and they don't have it, they'll just suspend the listing and they could, in theory, suspend their account. It's not a common thing, but it does happen occasionally. So once again, it's actually a question of rather than assuming that Japan is a difficult place to be compliant, it's about the same as everywhere else by the sound of it. But certainly you shouldn't be assuming before you launch a product that your product doesn't need certification. Again, it's just a question of educating yourself, right? But I would just flag up once again, let's flip it on its head and say, if you're selling in the US, just double check that you don't need compliance certificates. If you do, yes, it's another expense, but it's protecting yourself from getting that income stream rudely cut off in future.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just point that one out because I think quite a lot of people are quite ignorant about their end product sometimes. They make assumptions, which are a bit dangerous. So what other categories? And we talked about the ones, you know, you've mentioned already that fashion, although there's a great appetite for fashion, that the search volume is low on Amazon Japan. Are there any other categories that are difficult or that are best avoided in Amazon Japan?
No, I mean, the toys one's an interesting one. You know, we've not helped any clients in that as yet. So that, you know, that would be an interesting one to look at. Yeah, the cosmetics can be tricky again, the compliance side and the medical stuff. Supplements is again, this is another one that has lots of compliance requirements that we haven't cracked ourselves in terms of getting brands launched with supplements. So yeah, I don't.
Yeah, it's a huge area in the US. Is it competitive in Japan? Is it as it is in the US as well? Have you got that sort of marketplace problem as well?
I think it's growing. I think it's significantly behind the US, but I think it is a growing market.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know in depth about it, but yeah.
No,
yeah.
Of course. Yeah, it's a very specialist area. But so it sounds like if you've got a US supplements company, it's worth trying to crack Japan, but it does sound it's also an awkward thing. So it's certainly not something to rush to do.
Yeah, but I mean, it comes back to what we've just, you know, we've talked about already. If it's difficult to do, then there's, you know, it's harder for other people to do as well, isn't it? So.
Absolutely, yeah. If I had a US-based supplement company and I could see there's a growing market in Japan and it's a bit difficult to get into, I'd certainly get somebody on the case to see if they could crack it. That's for sure. So what categories, let's put it the other way around. What categories have you seen the greatest success for your clients? And we've been talking about the difficulties, which might be depressing people, but where have you seen the great successes for your clients?
Yeah, so sort of relatively simple products, homeware, DIY, sports and outdoors, beauty. They're the sort of four main ones I'd say that, you know, yeah, we've seen products do well in.
Excellent. So they're pretty straightforward, standard sorts of private label type products, really, then. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So generally, yeah. I mean, beauty presumably avoiding the cosmetic side, which you mentioned already, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, it's the sort of accessory side of things rather than products that you put on your skin.
Yeah, and again, just because you can sell it now doesn't mean there isn't some requirement buried in the terms of service in America, guys. Just always check the terms of service when you've got any kind of question mark like that. So what it's all sounding reasonably straightforward, really, and actually very similar to the barriers that you get in other countries. What are the other barriers to selling in Japan, and how do we overcome those?
I guess it's the content side, isn't it? The language, the customer support, seller support, which on the face of it feels very hard and intimidating, I think, for sellers. But I guess that's where people like me come in to kind of help facilitate that.
Okay. Yeah, so keyword research, getting listings, customer service. So presumably those are things you help with, because I'd imagine those are the most obvious barriers to anyone who's thinking of it.
Yeah, I mean, getting your listing set up correctly is obviously key. So yeah, that's a big part of our offering is to, you know, help people get their listing set up for Japan. And by that, we don't just translate things word for word. You know, we do the keyword research. Japan has three different alphabets, so it's kind of a it works. The keywords can be a bit different. It's like having you need a big thesaurus, basically, because you can write the words three different ways, potentially. So the computers obviously interpret them as three separate things. It's not like, doing keyword research for Japan is, definitely something that's important.
Yeah, it's quite specialist. Yeah, it makes sense. And I think also the idea of translating word for word anywhere is a really bad idea. And again, the US and the UK are similar markets, but just even if the people use the same exact keywords, which they often don't, if you're buying car accessories and you're looking for a windshield versus a windscreen or a hood versus a bonnet and a et cetera, or faucet versus a tap, there's a lot of different words. But more importantly, each marketplace is going to behave how each marketplace happens to behave. So if a lot of British people are looking for, and I'm just looking at the random objects in front of me here, but sunglasses with a strap on or something, that's not a very good idea. But I don't know, a ballpoint pen or whatever, it may be that the word ballpoint pen in the US is very, very highly searched and very competitive. But
suspenders is always a good one, I think.
You know? Yeah, right, suspenders. There you go. Yes, and meaning somewhat different things in different marketplaces. Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So it's never good to translate word for word. You need to do keyword research fresh in each country anyway, in my opinion. If you just use Google Translate to put a listing up in Germany and you're selling in the UK, you're probably missing out on crazy amounts of sales, because if you just did a proper job.
Yeah, I mean, to mention the Google Translate side of things, yes, there, as I think I mentioned already, doing sentences with Japanese, it just comes out gobbledygook, to be honest. So Google Translate for getting your listing set up is not an option. If you want to go the budget route, then employing a translator and getting it translated is the cheapest way, word for word, but you still need a human being to do it. So
I mean, going cheapskate on your listing is just, in my opinion, just ridiculous, because apart from, if you got the keywords right, then that's 50% of the work done. Because if you can't get ranked on page one and visible, then nothing else happens. You can have some beautiful photos in the world and even really nicely written listing, but if the keyword research is rubbish, then you're doomed. So I just think it's ridiculous to be short-scale. Yeah, to be cheapskate on that is just ridiculous.
To tie it back to the sort of market research as well, when you've looked at what's going on already, then that influences how you set up your listing as well. If you're looking at similar products, what keywords they're using, and making sure that you're using the right terminology that people are looking for is obviously very important.
Yeah, and at that point, you basically need a native speaker, I think, or somebody who works with them. I guess I can't see a way around that, really. So it's something I've been banging the drum for, getting people in from the UK into Germany for quite a long time. And I've there's one person I managed to persuade who just added an extra $600,000 to his revenue stream in the first year he did it. So I really think Japan is another one of those things that really is just a very, very overlooked opportunity. So guys, you heard it here first, or maybe not first, but you may have heard it for the 10th time here, and maybe it's the 10th time that gets you to take action. So if you've done that, John, you provided valuable service. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing some great detail, but also inspiring us to get into it. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll get you back to review the situation in a few months' time and see how things have developed. So thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. Million pound mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.